Well, the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese became a defining moment in American history. Early reporting described how she was stabbed to death on the front stoop of her New York City home in full view of 38 neighbors who didn't want to get involved. Well, 50 years after that notorious crime, Kevin Cook argues in his new book that much of what we think we know about the incident is just plain wrong. That book is Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. Cook writes for Sports Illustrated, Playboy, and Men's Health, and has appeared on ESPN, Fox Television, and CNN. He'll appear tonight at the Kansas City Library downtown. More on that in just a few minutes. And Kevin Cook, welcome. So nice to have you
here. Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
Well, this crime shocked the nation. Just how big a jolt was it?
It was a huge jolt, and it came at a time shortly after the Kennedy assassination, a time when people worried that big city life was dehumanizing us, turning us into people who didn't know our neighbors, who wouldn't lift a finger to help them. And this crime, at least the way that it was originally reported, fit that perfectly, fit a very edgy America and a certain narrative then carried the day. And this case has been told for 50 years as a poor young woman coming home from work in the middle of the night, stabbed in full view of dozens of witnesses who watched out their windows for a half hour as she was killed.
And it turns out, as your fine reporting for this book uncovers, that wasn't really the case.
It's much more complex than that. What really happened was, she was stabbed. She came home a little after 3 a.m. The man leaps.
What was she doing out at 3 o'clock in the morning?
She worked in a bar. Mm-hmm. She worked double shifts. This was a hardworking, very popular, likable, charismatic woman, an independent woman making her own way in the world in 1964. She tended bar for 6 hours and then managed the same bar in Queens, and so they close up. She's coming home at 3 a.m., and it's really the ultimate human nightmare. You're walking on a dark street all alone, and somebody leaps out and stabs you. She screamed loudly enough to wake up neighbors on both sides of the street, and at that point, everything diverges from the story we've been told. One man, a neighbor, lifted his window and yelled out, "Leave that girl alone." This is enough to make the attacker run away.
Pause, yeah.
Yes, he runs into the darkness. He actually sits in his car and waits to see what will happen. Kitty, bravely, walks around a corner, past a drugstore, back toward the railroad tracks where she can no longer be seen by the people on the street. Now there's nothing happening. After a certain amount of time, people are getting to their windows. They look out. They see nothing. All over. They go back to bed. The killer waits, sees the coast is clear, and then he finally attacks Kitty again, and that's the fatal stabbing. And my research did turn up that there was definitely an eyewitness to that. But while the story was told that there were 38 eyewitnesses, the real fatal attack, there was exactly one.
Wow. The number 38 came from where? 38 witnesses to this crime. In fact, there weren't 38. But how did that story get started?
Well, it came from a discussion that the New York Times editor, Abraham Rosenthal, had with the police chief. And this is a fascinating part of the story and part of the detective story that, the whole subject is quite grim at the same time like some television shows. The detection is really interesting, and I found that fascinating. 2 weeks after the crime, after the police commissioner tells the editor, A.M. Rosenthal, 38 witnesses. That's one for the books. 38 people didn't do anything for that girl. Suddenly, a crime that had been relatively unnoticed, certainly nationally, is on the front page of the New York Times, and it's a story not about the victim of a killing or about the killer, but about the witnesses, very specifically 38 of them. And I think that number had so much to do with the way the story stuck. If you read 38, you think, well, they didn't say 37, they didn't say 39, they really must know what they're talking
precise
about.
Precise number, yeah.
And again, it set the tone for the way this story has been understood for 50 years.
And the story that the Times told that day, Kevin, was a story about what? I mean, how 38 people just stood and watched and did absolutely nothing.
That's right. It was a story about apathy. And suddenly apathy was a beat in newspapers. I don't know if your paper had one, but almost every paper in the country did. And the Times pioneered this. It was supposed to explain a malady, a modern malady, that we were being dehumanized. And it took as its slogan something that the man at the top of the stairs, the one eyewitness to the fatal attack, who looked out and saw Kitty being stabbed, He later told the police when they said, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you call the police? He said, I didn't want to get involved.
Yeah.
And that becomes...
That was the lie.
Yes, and it was quoted worldwide. And suddenly, what was really a crime, and a remarkable, horrible crime, but with any number of stories going on all at the same time, became a symbol of modern malaise, of the fact that nobody cared about anybody else, at least in the cruel big city.
Kevin Cook is our guest. He's the author of a new book, Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street, downtown Kansas City. More information, kclibrary.org. Go there to grab a seat, kclibrary.org. So 38, the number 38 bystanders lingers in American history for decades. This case lingers for years and years. You come along, and how do you figure out that maybe the whole story was trumped up right from the start?
Well, I'm not the first to question the story. There's been some good journalism by Jim Ratzenberger. He wrote in the New York Times several years ago. There have been bits and pieces here and there. A fellow named Joe DeMay, who is a lawyer in New York City, lives in Kew Gardens. Joe DeMay would walk past the crime scene, which today looks almost exactly like it did in 1964, and try to imagine how it unfolded, and it just didn't add up. So he questioned some parts of it. I was able to come along later and really complete a new understanding of what had occurred.
You did that how, Kevin?
It was an enormous amount of help from people who knew Kitty, including particularly Kitty's partner, who helped me reconstruct that night and their lives together. And I do want to point out that the book Kitty Genovese is about her life and not just about her death.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as putting together what happened that night, there's a wonderful woman named Janine Abel who works in the Queens District Attorney's Office. And we found ourselves one day looking at a row of cardboard boxes full of documents that hadn't been looked at for 10 or 20 years that also helped put the situation, the story together.
So what did you find out? You're going through that, and did you have a tip, or are you just going through on your own
Yes, definitely going through, but trying to put different accounts together. And the original police reports, which come from a Freedom of Information request, the NYPD not particularly cooperative in this case, and it was not their proudest hour. You're able to get the actual accounts of the witnesses, and they vary so much. It's 3 a.m. Someone screams outside. This is a block where there's a bar that's usually open until 4 a.m. and people yelling their heads off in the middle of the night are not at all unusual. There are mm-hmm. fights spilling out. If you hear this shriek, and it does sound different from normal drunken hollering, if you're close enough to hear Kitty's words, and she did yell, "I've been stabbed," and various accounts, "Please help me, I've been stabbed. He stabbed me," you may get over to the window. Now, at that point, you're still groggy. Many of the people in the neighborhood were elderly. By the time you look out, if you haven't gotten there very quickly, Kitty has already, she's either alone, standing up, and she does walk around the corner where she's no longer visible, or that you may not see anything if she's already gone around the corner. People were also hesitant to call the police. They weren't just cowardly. Some were cowardly, could have helped Kitty, and did not.
And that's because the culture involving the police was so different back in those days, right?
It was utterly different. We owe the 911 emergency phone system largely to this case. And at that time, you can call zero, and that gets you to some operator someplace who has to put together where you are and what precinct to call. Or you can go to your yellow pages and look up the police number. You're often going to get a desk sergeant or a communications officer who, as likely as not, is going to invite you to mind your own business. We're the police here. What are you calling me about? A woman yelled? Oh, where is she now? Gone? Are they going to send a police car for that? Maybe not. And even though it was reported in the Times, no one phoned the police. That was a big part of the story. I ran across a sworn affidavit from a young man who was 14 years old at the time, said, "I called my dad to the window, and we saw this girl stagger around. My dad did call the police. He said, there's a girl who got hit. She's staggering around out there. You should send a police car." There's no record of this the next day, and when the police come, the dad gets a dirty look for reminding them perhaps they had come too late. The young man turns out to be a pretty good witness because when he grew up, he spent most of his career as a New York City police lieutenant.
No kidding. Well, at this point, I got to ask, what happened to Kitty in the moments after she stabbed? How is she able to get up and walk on her own? And why doesn't she seek help in those moments instead of walking by herself and disappearing around the corner?
Well, I think there was no help available. There was a bar that we talked about before that is usually open until 4 a.m. and sorrowfully, it closed early that night. There's a coffee shop closed. There's a railroad office closed. And at that point, Kitty has her lung has been punctured from the stab wound.
The initial stab.
In her back, yes. Mm-hmm. So slowly she's losing the breath even to call out. And what she did was try to get home. She went around to the back of the building where the entrance to her apartment was, wasn't able to get all the way there. She fell into the apartment of a neighbor and friend, the man who eventually was going to open the door, the man at the top of the stairs, who did not want to get involved. She fell in there and found shelter. And now, at least, it's warm in there. It's a cold night outside. She must have felt safe, at least for the moment. And one can only imagine the terror when the monster comes back and finds her again.
Again, this is 50 years ago, almost to the day. We're two days away
from... The day after
from,
tomorrow, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. If our listeners want to get involved here with our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. The perpetrator was a man named Winston Mosley. You describe him as a modern-day psychopath, Kevin. Who was he?
He was a very strange character. He did have a difficult childhood, abandoned by his mother. His father turns out not to have been his biological father. At the same time, he grew up to be a stable character by all appearances. He was gainfully employed. He was married to a nurse who worked nights. The very fact that she worked nights allowed him to prowl later on in his criminal career. He began as a burglar. That graduated to rape. It went from murder, from there to murder. He was such a strange character, fascinated by insects. He had an ant farm. He doted after dogs. He liked dogs better than human beings. He had a vicious German shepherd named Wolfie that slept under the bed. And this is a man who apparently felt no remorse.
I was going to say, he felt absolutely nothing about what he did to this woman.
That's right.
At trial, he's just absolutely stone cold, flat line on the whole thing.
And I was eager to hear his voice and managed to get my hands on an old, wrinkly, brown, reel-to-reel audio tape. And you play it and you hear this affectless voice that could easily have been a robot. He can describe what he had for lunch in the exact same tone in which he describes the details of this cruel killing. I mean, the number of times he stabbed Kitty, he describes as though he were just counting to 50. It's very chilling to think of Winston Mosley. And a remarkable sidelight to this story is he was convicted of murder, sentenced to death in the electric chair. That's a turned over an appeal, overturned and turned into a sentence of life in prison. 4 years after the crime in 1968, he escaped from Attica State Prison and went on a crime spree in Buffalo.
And the same thing happened all over again.
He raped two women in Buffalo. And I happen not to be a person who thinks that people should be put to death. That gives the government the power to kill its own citizens. But people who do support the death penalty can point to something like this. Had Winston Mosley been executed after he was convicted of first-degree murder, he's not around to terrorize two women in Buffalo later.
He lived how long?
He is still with us. He's 79 years old in Dannemora State Prison, the Clinton Correctional Facility.
Did you go talk to him?
I wanted to. He wouldn't talk to me. He has sworn off talking to the press after he got annoyed with ABC's 2020 many years ago when they didn't present him as the born-again type of person he claimed to be. I did come up with his 50 years of his correctional system records. He writes a lot of letters from prison. I've got the psychiatric reports. Here's a chilling job. If you're the psychiatrist hired by the court to interview Winston Mosley after he's committed these murders and determine whether he's sane or not. That makes for some remarkable reading. And I went all the way back. I wound up reading a longish junior high school, What I Want to Be When I Grow Up report by this murderer. He said he loved animals and was interested in maybe caring for animals, and if not that, law enforcement.
Wow. He's still with us. That's just amazing.
He is still up there. He actually wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times claiming that he had done society a service because his actions had let the world know that it's important to come to the aid of a neighbor when they need help.
Let's talk about that for a moment. Again, the sort of the aftermath of this case, not only 911 emergency phone service, as you've mentioned here, Kevin, but this whole notion of the bystander effect. What is it?
Well, it's a remarkable outgrowth of the case. There was such an outcry. What's the matter with us, with our society? How can people let this happen?
In plain view in front of all these people. Right.
That the misinterpretation of what happened that night led to some really good sociology. And the sociology explains that the bystander effect is a real thing. It's been corroborated again and again. If you're being attacked, mugged, stabbed, you're much more likely to get help if there are two or three people watching than if there are 20 or 30. And that's because if there are 20 or 30, everybody waits for somebody else to act first. Everybody thinks, well, there's got to be somebody brave. There's got to be somebody more bigger and stronger than I am who will do something. And what tends to happen is nobody does anything. And understanding the bystander effect has led to some very good social occurrences, like Good Samaritan laws in every state. We've got neighborhood watch programs that come out of that, and sometimes it doesn't work out so well, but overall, those may have saved some lives. So it's one of the ironies of the Kitty Genovese case that good sociology that may well have saved lives has come out of it.
Yeah, what an irony. I mean, all this comes out of a case, and none of it applied to the case it came out
well,
of.
Well, that's true, although there was one instance that night that is a classic case of the bystander effect. There was a couple that had a particularly good view of Kitty Genovese as she went around the corner, and the husband, Mr. Koshkin, reaches for the phone, and he's going to call the police. His wife stopped him and said, "Oh, don't! 30 people must have called the police by now."
Oh,
and that call was not made. Those were certainly people, and I'm definitely not saying in the book that nobody could have helped Kitty. There were two men who saw what happened, not only Carl Ross, the man at the top of the stairs, and I certainly don't claim that you should run and be expected to break up a stabbing. You should call the police. He didn't do that. There was also a superintendent across the street who saw the first stabbing, and he told the police later, "Well, I thought about going in and getting a baseball bat and going after the guy. Instead, he went downstairs and took a nap."
Yeah, that story just almost dropped me when I read that. I just couldn't believe that. Yeah,
and I mean, that's certainly chilling. And there was a young woman, a stewardess, who did call the police, but got so frightened and terrified, didn't know her English very well. And remember, in those days before 911, you have to identify yourself first. There's no where is your emergency? They want to say, "Who are you?" She was afraid, and put the phone back down. And there was almost a different story for every window that night.
Hmm. Well, have you ever witnessed a crime or other incident firsthand, and instead of helping, maybe you took a video with your phone or did nothing? We're talking about the bystander effect. We'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us to uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us @kcuruptodate. So in the wake of the Kitty Genovese case, Kevin, what's the most famous case that might have been impacted by this bystander effect that we're talking about here?
Well, there are quite a few. I mean, one was here in Kansas City not long ago with a fireman and the policeman. There was a case in China not long ago when a man was struck by a car and people are walking past, literally walking past him. Apathy certainly exists, and the bystander effect explains, I think, a good deal of why people hesitate to act, but sometimes people are just looking for a spectacle and they take a picture. The case that the Jodie Foster movie The Accused was based on is another one that is often mentioned. They are innumerable. I think everyone is different, but one thing that definitely happens is whenever something like that comes up, we hear the name Kitty Genovese again.
That's interesting. You mentioned The Accused. That movie was a turning point in my life, and I've mentioned this on this program before. I went and saw that film. At the end of it, it's a very graphic, horrible scene. And I turned to my wife and I said, I'm paying money to watch this. I can't do this anymore. And ever since then, early 90s, I've been screening what I go see because I can't handle that stuff anymore. Don't want to see it.
Well, I mean, that's an example.
It doesn't go with my popcorn very well.
That's for sure. Yeah. But it's remarkable to find out the different ways this case ramifies in other people's lives. The Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor gave in high school a speech about the Kitty Genovese case, urging others to get involved. And maybe the starkest example is Chesley Sullenberger, Captain Sully, who landed his plane in the Hudson River. He had learned about the Kitty Genovese case when he was a schoolboy, about 13 years old. When he read about that, he thought, oh, how could those New Yorkers be that way, let such a thing happen? And he vowed if he ever had a chance to help people, to save people's lives, he was going to act. He was going to do it.
I saw his name in your book. And, boy,
He does one of the most heroic things you could do with that airplane. And then he remembered that when the passengers are out on the wing of the floating plane, he saw boats coming from the New York City side, both sides. But he was looking on the New York City side and thought something has changed. And he felt such great warmth coming to him from New York City. And
that's great.
That's a remarkable thing that's come from this story.
Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Kevin Cook is here. Kitty Genovese is his new book, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. Sue from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi. I want to share a story where I did indeed get involved.
Yeah.
It must have been at least 30 years ago, and I was driving up Brookside with my kids in the car, and I saw somebody trying to mug an older lady, and I stopped my car and yelled at him, and he took off. She grabbed her purse and was able to get her purse, and I put her in. We didn't have cell phones then, so I just put her in the car and took her to the police station, and the police said they'd get her home. But it was just a very simple little act. You couldn't just stand there and let them take this lady's purse.
How nervous were you intervening like that, Sue?
I don't remember. I don't think so. My friend said, you were crazy to do that. And I said, well, I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, I didn't think. I just stopped and I told the kids to stay in the car and I yelled. And I didn't have to get out because when he heard me yelling, he just ran away.
I bet your kids remember that to this day, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Sue, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I like your station.
Thank you. Let's go to Tom from Kansas City, Kansas. Tom, you're on with Kevin Cook. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I had a similar experience about 15 years ago. I was over near the Nelson Art Gallery, and I saw this guy basically knock two elderly women down and grab their purses and take off. That was occurred probably about 50, 60 feet in front of me, and I jumped out of my car, and I confronted the guy, hoping, that he would drop the purses and run, and he pulled a screwdriver on me. And at that point, I decided not to tackle him or something like that, but I kind of walked along with him until his brother came along and picked him up in a car about 100 yards down the road. And then afterwards, the police said I probably recommended I shouldn't have walked along with him, or at least as close as I did, because of myself in danger.
That's interesting. Hey, what was going through your mind as you were walking along with him, Tom? I mean, were you thinking, do I stay with this or do I bail out?
Well, I was hoping that I could just keep him in contact because there was actually quite a few folks around, and I thought somebody was calling the police or maybe some security from the Nelson would be close by or something. I just wanted to keep the guy in sight so that I could tell the professionals what it was. And, like I said, when I got out of my car and confronted the guy, if he didn't drop the purses, I initially was going to tackle him. But he pulled that screwdriver on me, and I backed off.
Well, I admire your courage, Tom. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Alan from Kansas City, Kansas. Alan, you're on up today. Good morning.
Good morning. I heard you all talking. The biggest thing is fear. People are afraid.
Sure they are.
I drive a truck for a living, and one night, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm walking through the backside of a truck stop. You know, it's dark. There's trailers, trucks, walking through there. This guy pops out from behind the trailer and pulls a knife on me. He says, give me all your money. Well, he expected I was just going to hand it over to him, and I didn't. I told him no. And he said, well, give me your money. And I said, no. he just expected that fear was going to, you know, make me do what he wanted me to do.
Right, right, right.
And I told him no, you know, he was like, okay, what do I do now?
Right.
So, you know, sometimes if I had my family there, I probably would have done the situation totally different. But being by myself, you know, usually I try to not let fear.
Well, Alan, I appreciate the call. And Kevin, this makes me think that almost every time someone gets involved in a situation like this in today's society, people assume somebody's got a gun, right? I mean, that's the issue.
It's certainly an element of it. And I think one thing that we've just heard from your listeners, there's a lot of decency and a lot of courage out there, and at least as much as there is apathy. One thing that one of the professors that I spoke to studies the what they call pro-social behavior, trying to encourage people to get involved, talks about is the advent of the cell phone is not only can you very quickly call 911 anonymously and get a police car going
you
to where it needs to be.
You can record it, too.
You can take a picture. And one thing is if there's a guy with a knife, a guy with a screwdriver, someone harassing somebody, any number of things that you can witness from a distance, you can still take a cell phone photo, and that makes the criminal wonder whether he's been
outed.
Taken outed exactly right now, and you don't have to get close, and that's certainly one advantage that witnesses have today.
Well, we're out of time here. What an interesting conversation and an interesting book, too. Kevin Cook is the author of that book, Kitty Genovese, The Murder of the Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America. And again, Kevin speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch. To grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. Kevin, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it.
You bet.